police would arrive en masse. But he stayed behind Banfield, nudging him with the gun in his pocket. Dom hadn't fired this gun in years, and he sure hoped he didn't have to test it. It was a Walther PPK his brother Brian had given him as a gift when he graduated from the FBI Academy. It was more a showgun than anything. But right now Dom Smith was somewhere under the control of Darren Albright, so he'd pulled his Walther out of his gun safe, cleaned, lubed, and loaded it with 38 hollow point ammunition, and then rushed over to Banfield's place of work. In the elevator ride up, Dom saw the older man positioning himself to catch the reflection of his attacker in the polished metal doors. Dom just said, "Head down, or I'll shoot you through the kneecaps when we get to your office." Banfield looked down the rest of the way. Inside the tiny one-room office, Banfield made his way to his computer at his desk and logged on. His hands shook while he typed. Dom stood behind him and held the pistol to the back of his head. "Any chance I could get you to move that gun? Just a little?" "No chance at all." "It makes me nervous." "You should be nervous. Fear is a reasonable reaction for you right about now. I'll be honest. If I were you, I'd be scared shitless." Banfield did his best to concentrate on what he was doing. Finally, he initiated the chat. The relief he felt when Bertoli answered on the other end of the Cryptocat connection was blunted by the angry and armed man behind him. He said, "If I even suspect you of trying to tip her off, you won't live to see the sunrise. I'll kill you right here, right now." Harlan held his quivering fingers over the keyboard. "I wouldn't think about it." "Of course you would think about it. You're thinking about it right now. But if you do it, if you try one little thing, you die slow and nasty. I won't ask you if you understand, because I see it in your eyes. You do understand. You were a foreign correspondent. I know you've been to some of those third world shitholes where they've made torturing people into an art." "Well, guess what, asshole? I have to."
Who are you?"
"I'm that thing you've always known was out there, in the shadows. Except I'm not out there. I'm here, with a gun pressed to your head." Banfield only uttered a hoarse, "Dear God." "Relax. I'll slip away quietly and let you live if you just make a series of correct decisions over the next few minutes. But I will kill you if you give me any cause to do so." Harlan was certain this man was one of the operatives he'd spent the last several years trying to uncover, a group deeper and darker than the CIA, working here within America's borders, against journalists and others that would reveal the existence of the shadow government. The man behind said, "Find out where he is." Harlan typed, "I wanted to make sure you are okay."
"I am fine."
"And our friend?"
"He is fine."
"Anything I can do?"
"Not at this time. Thank you."
Banfield hesitated a long time, then typed, "I need to know if I am safe here, if there is any exposure to me."
"Why would there be?"
Banfield looked up at Caruso.
"I don't know what to say."
Caruso told Banfield what to write, and he typed, "The FBI has been in his house. Can you ask Ethan if there was anything that could lead the FBI back to me? He called me on my primary cell phone once, many months ago. Any chance he wrote the number down? If so, I might still have time to leave town." Banfield finished typing, and then his finger moved to the enter key. But before he could depress it, Dom reached down and snatched the older man's hand back. Banfield was startled.
"What's wrong?"
Dom stared into Banfield's eyes, a hard, cruel glare.
"Ethan.
Above, you called him our friend. That was early on. You were scared. You've done what I've asked, so you relaxed a little, and now you are trying to tip her off. You don't call him Ethan in your comms to Gianna, do you? Banfield did not answer, but his face twitched. Dom said, no, you wouldn't. Not Ross, either. You just call him our friend, don't you? Banfield nodded. If you are lying, I will fail in my mission. If I fail in my mission, I will have a lot of free time. Plenty of time to find you.
I swear it.
Fix the message and send it. Banfield did so, and there was a long pause, and then a reply. He says he might have written your number down. He doesn't remember. I think you should get out of town. Does that tell you where he is? Dom asked.
It does. Ethan Ross is in Geneva.
You are sure?
Absolutely.
The World HQ of ITP is Gianna's home right there in the city. And she'd take him there?
She has support from local government, other European nations with consulate or UN offices there. It is safe ground.
You have an address?
No.
Dom lifted the gun again.
Not an address. But they work out of the University of Geneva.
Good enough. Dom watched while Banfield ended the chat and logged off. It's your lucky day, Banfield. You don't die. Dom ripped the computer out of the wall and picked it up. I'm taking this with me as collateral to ensure your silence. And if, at any time, I find out you communicated with Ross or anyone in the ITP, one of my colleagues will come for you. And my colleagues aren't nearly as much fun to be around as I am.
I won't talk. I swear it.
Dom left Banfield alone and shaking in his small office. 42. The Four Seasons Hotel de Berg in Geneva sits overlooking the Rhône River next to the Mont Blanc Bridge. From her sixth-floor suite, Gianna Bertoli gazed out at the view, a cup of coffee in her hand and a placid smile on her face. Switzerland felt so much more secure and civilized than Panama, even more than Washington, D.C. She was glad to have the experiences of those cities behind her. In all her time with the ITP, she'd never done anything at all in the field, and now she doubted very much she ever would again. It was good to be home in Geneva, safe among friends. She turned away from the view, stepped off the balcony, and sat back down with Ethan. He'd just poured himself his first cup of coffee of the day, and she regarded him while he sipped. He looked terrible, as if he had aged a decade in the week she had been around him. Even though he had a suite as large and comfortable as hers just across the hall, it was obvious he hadn't slept. She saw veins in his eyes, dark circles under them, and his hands seemed to have developed a tremor she hadn't noticed before.
Ethan, why don't you have some orange juice? You need the vitamins.
He sipped coffee with a jittery hand and ignored her comment.
When we got here last night, we had the entire floor to ourselves. This morning there were a dozen people moving luggage into their rooms. Who are all these people?
Colleagues with ITP. I've called everyone in Europe here. A show of force, let's say. They are staying four or five to a suite. By the end of the day, we will have 25 friends close by. Journalists, activists, attorneys, human rights proponents, university professors.
Ethan put his cup down. And they all know about me?
No, absolutely not. None of them do. They know I am here, and I invited them.
When we arrived from Panama, I decided we needed to wrap ourselves in the organization. It is best for you right now. We have the entire floor to ourselves.
Not exactly. I noticed Mohammed had more men with him. There are the four who pulled us out of Panama, and now two more guys that look just as dangerous as the first four have shown up.
Yes, I know.
Who are they?
Gianna said, Mohammed told me they were friends of his who could help us with security.
Why does a computer hacker have friends who can provide security?
As I understand it, they are part of his organization.
His Lebanese organization?
Gianna sipped coffee.
Yes?
Why do you say it like that?
The four on the plane.
They were speaking Arabic, Ethan said.
But did you hear what they called each other?
I did not understand them.
Shiraz, Isfahan, Kashan, Ormond.
They are cities in Iran.
I don't know about Mohammed, but those guys are Iranian.
Gianna shook her head. I've been to his offices in Beirut. I know who he is. I don't know about the other men.
What does it matter?
They saved us from the American assassins. I, for one, am grateful.
We don't even know the men who attacked us in Panama were Americans.
Who else could they be?
Who else wants you dead?
The Israelis, maybe.
But does it really matter?
We know they work together.
Ethan conceded the point.
The question remains, what do I do now?
I'd like to talk to you about just that.
I hope you will listen to me and continue to put your trust in me.
The two of them spent the morning discussing Ethan's future, and by 11 a.m. Ethan had reluctantly agreed to Gianna's plan. He went back to his suite, and soon Gianna knocked on Mohammed's door. She found him working in his room, on his phone, with his laptop in front of him. Four of his six colleagues were there as well, but they were just sitting around. Gianna did not have the impression they were computer hackers themselves. She sat with Mohammed at a table just inside his closed balcony. She said, I have spoken to Ethan, and together we have come to a decision. The Americans have gone to great lengths to kill him. There will be no detente. He realizes this now. The only way he can save himself is to get out in the open.
Mohammed did not understand.
What does that mean, out in the open?
Gianna said, Ethan and I have decided. We will go public. Very public.
Mohammed shook his head with an apologetic smile.
You can't do that.
We will hold a press conference here in the hotel tomorrow at noon. I will reveal myself as director of the project. This is of no consequence to me, as I will not return to the field. I prefer to remain here in Geneva and to work as a figurehead promoting our work. Ethan will detail the events that brought him here, including America's attempts to kill him, both on the streets of Washington and in Panama.
Gianna smiled. By the Tuesday news cycle, both the work of the project and the crimes of America will be on the lips of every journalist in Europe.
Mohammed stood, crossed around the table and in front of the Swiss woman.
Gianna, that is a very bad idea.
She put her hand on his shoulder. He looked at it awkwardly, and she pulled it away. Recovering quickly, she said,
Don't take this the wrong way, but publicity is not your area of expertise. We will make an announcement that Ross was a prisoner of conscience working for the American government. He was chased out of the country by assassins. Assassins who killed his girlfriend, and then he was pursued by the Americans in Central America. Once we go public like this, he will be safe. He will be surrounded by people here in Europe who will protect him, and the Americans won't dare try anything once the word gets out.
Mohammed banged his fist on the table.
And the data in his possession, Our entire objective was to get control of that data. Have you forgotten?
Relax. Of course I haven't forgotten. Your plan was brilliant, and it worked almost flawlessly. When you told me you had software that could raid the U.S. government's top-secret databases, I knew Ethan Ross could serve as our inside man, if only we created a situation desperate enough for him. But we never counted on people dying in the process.
Mohammed did not reply. Bertoli's chest heaved.
It's ironic, isn't it?
In our efforts to portray America as a lawless nation, we have found ourselves surprised by their capacity for lawlessness.
Nothing has surprised me to date, Gianna,
except for the astonishing fact you want to tell the entire world about Ross.
I'm sorry, but the moment you do that, we will be swept to the side as the world's intelligence agencies begin to muscle in. The Four Seasons will be crawling with spies from all over the planet. They will all have their sights on Ross and his data.
We will protect him. Hotel security will protect him. The Canton police will protect him. When we go public with the news of the assassinations and their attack in Panama, America will be embarrassed, and we will capitalize on that. Ethan will, in his own time, allow the ITP access to the cash. When America learns he is here, we won't have any time.
The Swiss woman cocked her head slightly.
You do want to help the ITP, yes? Your allegiance is to us, is it not?
Mohammed said, of course.
Why do you ask?
Ethan seems to think you are working for Iranian intelligence.
I told him this was crazy. I've been aware of your operation in Lebanon for years.
But I have to admit, you are acting strangely now, as if you have some other objective for the American files.
He took a calming breath before saying, I simply believe you are making a mistake.
Bertoli eyed the small man across the table for a long moment. Finally, she replied,
The decision is made. We've notified the media.
Mohammed stood and stormed out of his suite without another word. Ethan Ross sat at dinner in a private banquet room in the Four Seasons, surrounded by more than 24 prominent hacktivists, human rights lawyers, journalists, and other hangers-on of Gianna Bertoli and the ITP. A ring of security officers, all provided by the hotel, stood just outside the door to the banquet room. While the American NSC employee had made no statement today, that would come tomorrow, the ITP members present had been putting the pieces together themselves. This American in their midst obviously came from Washington. Bertoli's major announcement would detail who he was and what exactly he had done. Bertoli herself had leaked out a little to some of her guests. It was publicity 101. She knew she needed to create a buzz before tomorrow's big reveal. Wine and champagne flowed throughout the meal. Any excuse was a good excuse for a celebration among the members of the project on those few occasions when they all got together. But tonight's revelry seemed to be in keeping with the magnitude of Bertoli's coming announcement. Mohammed was noticeably absent tonight. He'd been on his telephone all day. Ethan had seen him in the lobby, up on the 6th floor, and even standing out on his balcony. His colleagues stayed close to him at all times, almost like some sort of bodyguard detail. Throughout dinner, the toasts, and the revelry, Ethan sat quietly, his misgivings growing by the minute. The celebratory nature of the evening seemed out of phase with everything that had happened. And more than this, he had another concern. He just couldn't shake the sensation that this entire affair had been orchestrated to lead him to this point. Like he had been coaxed and prodded and manipulated into the decisions he had made, the actions he had taken, the path he had traveled. The sense of being a pawn ran completely counter to his self-image. But the dinner party convinced him the International Transparency Project stood to gain mightily from his misfortune. That said, he hadn't met a single person in the ITP, Bertoli included, who he thought capable of pulling his strings the way they had been pulled to cause all of this. He could not help wondering if some other entity was involved. It was too much to contemplate. So he didn't. Ethan reached for the closest bottle of champagne and filled his water glass with it, telling himself he needed to relax to be able to think clearly in order to deal with what was still to come. He'd get shit-faced drunk tonight, and tomorrow he would deal with tomorrow. 43. Dominic Caruso and Adara Sherman arrived in Geneva, Switzerland at 7:40 a.m. on a non-stop United flight from Dulles. They didn't rent a car at the airport. Instead, they took a cab directly to the Hotel Saint-Gervais in the city center, then checked into a deluxe room on the third floor. Initially, they planned on hunting for Ross and Bertoli here in Geneva for as long as it took, but their hunt was greatly simplified when word came from Jerry Hendley that the ITP would be holding a major press conference at the Four Seasons at noon. It was obvious the conference would involve Ross, and Dom planned on being there so he could tail him from the hotel. To that end, Adara walked a couple of blocks to rent a four-door BMW sedan that would blend in here in luxurious Geneva, and Dom left the hotel to go to a nearby motorcycle shop, where he rented a fully gassed BMW F800 GS, a helmet, and a dark gray one-piece thermal motorcycle suit. He and Adara thought it a near certainty they would have to do some vehicle surveillance, so they wanted to have two vehicles to spread their coverage. There was an immediate snag in this plan, however. All the talk on the local news was of a late winter storm brewing in the mountains to the south of Geneva, forecast to hit the city by midday. Dom wasn't crazy about biking through a blizzard, so he considered renting a second car instead of a bike. But he stuck with the bike and told himself if the weather turned too bad, he could park it and grab a four-wheeled vehicle instead. An hour later, he and Adara met back at their hotel room. She had scoped out the Four Seasons on her way back from the rental car office and offered to draw Dom a map of the interior, but he decided he'd drive over for a look himself. Dom had no plans to go inside the building once the press arrived for the conference, so he headed off immediately. Light snow began falling as he parked in a lot next to the Church of the Holy Trinity, just a block from the Four Seasons. He walked over to the hotel and noticed several satellite trucks out front already. He ducked in a side entrance and started walking around the ground floor. He wanted to get a feel for where Ross might go after the press conference. He pictured the American being shuffled out a side exit into a waiting vehicle, but from Dom's limited view of the banquet hall from his vantage point in the lobby, he decided it was just as likely he would come right out the front of the building and onto the street there. Dom worried he'd have a hard time knowing where to station himself for static overwatch outside, but while he thought about it, his satellite phone chirped in his pocket. He grabbed it and saw it was Jerry Hendley. "Hey, Jerry. It's about 4 a.m. in D.C., isn't it? Don't remind me. Listen up. Just heard from my contact at Justice. Your friend Albright is there in Geneva, and he has been given a green light to arrest Ross." Dom was impressed, but still incredulous. "I hope he doesn't expect it to be easy." "I guess not. He's got an HRT team with him, as well as a surveillance unit. They're going in hard and fast." "Did the Swiss give them the okay to do this?" "Negative. FBI is going to try and snatch him out from under the Swiss. The concern is the scrape. Even if it falls into Swiss hands, it won't be secure. They are an ally, but we can't say they don't have people in their midst who would misuse the data. We have to take it off the playing field. We can kiss and make up with the Swiss after the fact." When is it going to happen? It's imminent from what I can tell. Right there at the Four Seasons, before the press confab. It's the only time they know where he will be with certainty, and the last chance to get him before this all goes public. Dom looked around the lobby. For all he knew, there could be FBI surveillance teams in the building. I guess I'd better get out of here before Albright shows up.
That sounds like a good idea, son.
Caruso left the hotel immediately, then headed back to the parking lot. He stood next to his bike and looked to the sky. Even through the snowfall, he could see massive gray thunderheads hanging over the mountains to the south. He called Adara and asked her to head to the lobby of the Four Seasons and to keep him posted about what was going on. Ethan put on a suit he'd bought that morning in the men's store in the lobby of the hotel. He tied his tie, and while he did so, he looked at himself in the bathroom mirror. Ethan was narcissistic, but he retained enough realism to recognize that he looked like shit. His eyes were sunken and rimmed with dark circles, his cheeks sallow from poor sleep and worse diet. He took a minute with his hair, but finally he gave up and sat down on the edge of his bed. He bent over, covering his head with his hands. He remained motionless for over a minute, and moved only when there was a knock at his door. Gianna stepped in a moment later, sat next to him, and reached to hug him, but Ethan pushed away.
"What is wrong? We have to be in the conference room in 15 minutes. Mohammed's men will escort us down."
Ross shook his head.
"I can't do it."
"What do you mean?"
"I'm not going public. I want to reach out to the FBI before we have the press conference. I'll tell them I'll turn over the drive. They aren't going to offer immunity. But they might..."
"No.
You can't do that."
"Of course I can.
I want to go home. It was never my intention to be a spy for the Iranians."
Gianna shook her head.
"I told you. Mohammed is Lebanese, and Mohammed works for me."
"Are you really that naive?" Ross had worked with the ITP in part because he felt he was more intelligent than those he worked around in the government. Suddenly it hit him that he was more intelligent than the ITP, and the effects of this realization were devastating. Gianna sighed slowly and stepped closer to Ethan.
"Look, he always told me he was Lebanese. As I said, I've been to his office. But if he is Iranian, what does it matter?"
Ethan just muttered, "I've got to get out of here." Bertoli addressed Ross as if he were one of her underlings now.
"Let me tell you how things work. The best hacker groups in the world are in China. Next best are in Russia. Then come the Iranians. They are better than the private groups here in Europe."
"Why don't you work with the Chinese or Russians?"
"The Chinese work for their state. We do collaborate with the Russians on occasion, but they are just in it for the money."
"And the Iranians?
What are they in it for?"
"They are in it for the same reasons we are."
"To damage the West?"
She shrugged.
"If you like. You are a fool. Mohammed and his group are under direct orders from Tehran. He doesn't work for you. You work for him."
"That's ridiculous.
Let me ask you this. When you got my intelligence about the Peace Flotilla attack 4 months ago, did you give it to Mohammed?"
She hesitated.
"We needed them to unpack the compressed files and redact any names. That is a time-consuming process. Mohammed took care of it."
Ross understood everything now. His career in the National Security Council went a long way to helping him put the pieces together of a truly brilliant and diabolical scheme.
"Mohammed played me all the way through.
Through you, he learned about Yacoby. He knew the Palestinians would go after him, and they knew this would reveal your whistleblower in U.S. intelligence. All it took was something that would make me run. He thought for a moment. Like an assassination attempt. The door to Ethan's suite opened. Standing there in the doorway were Shiraz and Isfahan, leather coats fat with stowed weapons under their arms. Another man appeared in the hall and entered the room behind them. It was Muhammad, but it took Gianna and Ethan seconds to realize this. Gone was his awkward demeanor and college student clothes. In its place, he wore a suit and tie. He stood taller, his shoulders were back, and he appeared utterly confident.
Well done, Ethan. You have it exactly right so far. But let me expand on it for you.
Ethan looked around.
You've bugged my room?
Muhammad smiled, held his hands up in apology. He said,
My initial vision for this operation was too narrow. I had access to an IT professional at NSA, and I knew I could persuade him to build the crawler we needed to get the secure data, but I did not have the inside man I needed to put the crawler on the network. When Gianna gave me the flotilla files to work on, I saw that whoever passed this intel from NSC might well have access to much more. A great deal of vital information about America and its assets around the world. I couldn't find this person on my own, so I had to draw him or her out into the open. The way to do that was to give the information about Jacobi to the Palestinians. I knew they would act. I even helped coordinate the action in India, bringing the Palestinians and the cell of Yemenis together. I knew it would be clear the American data leak led to the attack. There would be an investigation. I was getting the Americans to do the work for me, you see. Once the man at NSC was drawn out, I knew Gianna would reach out to him. I knew she would offer him protection. He smiled. And I knew I had to be there, in the middle of it all.
He turned to Bertolli.
I could not be certain you would be able to get him out of the U.S. That was a very weak link in my scheme. But after consulting with colleagues in Tehran, I was given approval to go myself to America to assist.
We found out his name from Banfield. We put surveillance on him ourselves. But it would do no good for us to take him. We could have done it, though it would have been a dangerous exposure. But he had to take the data first, to commit the scrape. Muhammad smiled. My friend Gianna was complicit in this. I told her about the crawler. She thought she could use her power of persuasion to get you to download the files, but to her surprise, you were not as easy to manipulate as she had hoped. He looked at Ross. So I increased the pressure. We made it obvious you were being followed, but still you were stubborn. You wouldn't download the files. So we had to get even more serious.
Ethan understood. Eve, you murdered her.
It wasn't an assassination attempt on me. You were trying to scare me.
Muhammad smiled.
You were scared, weren't you? You actually ducked and made shooting her easy. It was beneficial. She was suspicious of you. Had she lived, she might have tipped off the FBI and gotten you arrested. That would have been unfortunate for us. I also knew you needed her credentials to access the virtual private network to get on the CIA's network remotely. I put the chances at 50% that you would just lose your mind when she died and not go through with the scrape. But I underestimated your cunning.
Ethan mumbled,
She wasn't going to turn me in.
Muhammad shrugged.
Then I overestimated her patriotism. Anyway, it all turned out perfectly.
You used me,
Ross mumbled.
A vulnerable asset is a valuable asset.
You used me!
Gianna shouted it in fury. Mohammed pointed in her face.
Of course I used you. You were easy to use. You knew I had the crawler, and you knew you had to get Ethan to install it. But you were helpless in that regard. I made him scrape the files.
And now what will you do?
Asked Ethan. I wanted to kidnap you after Panama and bring you to Tehran, but my leadership demanded I preserve my relationship with ITP, if at all possible. I thought it was possible. I thought we could come back here. Gianna and I could work on you for a few days, wear you down, persuade you to give up the password to your intelligence scrape. But that was not to be. You insisted on going public, drawing attention to yourself, at which point the Americans would kidnap or kill you. I can't wait around for someone else to show up and take the breach that I worked so long and hard to create. I am going to take it myself. Now.
He motioned to Shiraz, who walked over to the laptop computer on the table. The Quds Force man opened the lid, then turned back to Ross.
Mohammed said, I assume the files are on the computer. You wouldn't have left them on the crawler drive.
We need the passwords, please.
What will you do with the information?
We will take the information back to Iran.
Of course.
Ethan shook his head.
I'm not going to tell you anything.
Mohammed smiled. It was sinister, more so because it was completely out of phase of the personality of the man Ethan had been around for the past several days, as if his body had been taken over by another being. The Iranian said, Of course you say that now. Let's see what you say when I am through with you.
Suddenly, Kashan spun into the doorway, entering the room at a run. He said something in Farsi that Ross couldn't understand, but it was telling that the men weren't troubling themselves with Arabic any longer. There was no pretense but that they were agents from Tehran. Mohammed's face went from calm confidence to obvious alarm.
The FBI is here, outside.
He motioned toward the door.
We are leaving now.
Bertoli said, Where are you taking us?
We must hurry.
He was emphatic, brusque.
We'll go downstairs to the parking garage, now.
Shiraz stuffed the laptop into the backpack, slipped it onto his back. Isfahan looked out the doorway, checking up and down the hall. Ross wondered where the other Iranians were, but he did not ask.
I'm not going anywhere with you. I'm staying right here.
Isfahan and Shiraz pointed silenced pistols at Ethan and Gianna. In seconds, everyone was moving toward the stairs.
44. Mohammed Mobashiri and two other members of his team led Ross and Bertoli through the underground garage quickly and professionally. They had the air of a close protection detail, although the two Westerners with them were most definitely prisoners.
Gianna Bertoli said, We should stay in the hotel and let the police deal with them. The Swiss government won't let the Americans take Ethan. They have no authority.
Mobashiri shook his head as he walked. The FBI will break down every door in the building to get to our friend.
So we are leaving the hotel? Bertoli asked.
Correct. But it's freezing outside.
Your coats, as well as the rest of your luggage, have already been removed from your rooms and will be brought to you immediately.
What? Your people have been through my things?
Gianna's voice echoed in the parking garage. Her tone was caustic with the breach of her privacy.
Mobashiri conferred in Farsi with someone on his phone. Ross asked,
You don't think the FBI will have people outside?
The Iranian took the phone from his ear.
The FBI is watching the exits of the hotel. But where we are going, there is no hotel exit. I assure you, I have your safekeeping under control. I need you. Keep walking. They stepped into a narrow stairwell that was clearly not part of the Four Seasons property, and they ascended to street level. When one of the Iranians arrived at a door, he opened it slowly, and he looked out before indicating to the others they should follow. Ross thought he would find himself on one of the streets outside the hotel, but instead he saw they were in a long, narrow courtyard area chock-full of construction. The Four Seasons was actually connected to an entire block of 5 to 8-story buildings, and this paved area was closed for renovations. The inner walls of the apartments and office buildings here had all been covered with green mesh to keep the windows safe from the ongoing construction, and there was little activity in any of the office buildings. Ross suddenly felt the uncomfortable sensation of solitude. He'd quickly moved from a hotel floor with dozens of people around to here, completely isolated other than a small group around him he did not trust. They continued through the outdoor construction area. There was little snowfall here because of the high buildings and the wind. It was clear to Ross the Iranians had set this escape plan up earlier, although he couldn't guess how they could have known to do so. He expected now they would all head to the street and hail taxis, although he wondered if Mohammed had some other trick up his sleeve. For the first time, he tried to directly resist the Iranians. He stopped walking, and he reached out and took Gianna by the arm to stop her as well. "Listen to me, Mohammed. I'm not taking another fucking step. You aren't getting the intelligence. I want to stay here." Mobashiri barely broke stride. He nodded to the man on Ross's left, who slammed his fist into the back of the American's shoulder, knocking him forward and off balance. As soon as he was able to turn around in hopes of defending himself from another strike, Ethan saw the Iranian had produced a black pistol, and although the man held it at hip level, it was pointed directly at Ross's chest. Gianna started to scream, but a second man put his arm around her neck and covered her mouth with his hand. He pulled her onward in a headlock. In English, Mobashiri said, "I ask everyone to keep moving, please." Ethan Ross turned with his hands raised to ward off any follow-on blows, and he resumed walking through the quiet courtyard. Caruso would have given 6 months of his campus salary to be in the Four Seasons when Darren Albright and the HRT studs took Ross down. He was certain there would be video taken of the event, and it would play in a constant loop on the cable channels back home for a long time. The video might cause problems. He was damn sure the UN and the EU and God knows who else would have an aneurysm when they saw it, especially if Albright and company had to go in loud in the posh European hotel. "The video will be cool," he told himself. "But it would be so much better to be in there watching firsthand, so he could see the color drain out of that prick Ross's face when he realized the rest of his life would be spent in a 10-by-12 can in a Supermax prison." But Dom knew he couldn't be inside. He had to keep his own face out of the constant video loop, and he sure as hell didn't want Albright to know he was here. He was already thinking about the after-effects of this operation, and he didn't need a guy like Albright any more curious about him and his organization than he already was. So Dom went back to his bike parked in the lot in front of the Church of the Holy Trinity, and he zipped his jacket tightly and slipped on his helmet. It was snowing heavily now, but he fired up his BMW F800 GS and drove slowly back toward the hotel, hoping to at least get a glimpse of the tail end of the arrest, protected from both hotel surveillance cameras and the FBI's watchful eyes by the tinted visor of his helmet. He motored slowly back through the snowfall, along with the light traffic, staying in the turning lane to make a left in front of the hotel. When he made the turn, he noticed 3 silver SUVs parked across the street along the Rhone River. He thought it likely the vans belonged to the tactical team,
and this was confirmed a moment later when he saw men behind the wheels who looked like they had been sent by central casting. Short, cropped military haircuts, muscular necks disappearing into nondescript dark coveralls, and black watch caps. Dom smiled inside his helmet. The takedown was going on right now in the building on his left. Catching Ethan Ross wouldn't bring anything approaching the closure he needed to get over the Yockeby's deaths, but it was a hell of a lot better than nothing. Plus, it would dam up the most dangerous leak to the U.S. intelligence community in history. Dom wanted to park right here by the vans to watch the action, but he saw no movement at the front of the Four Seasons, and he decided he had a couple minutes before Ross was frog-marched out. He didn't want to draw any attention to himself, so he stayed in traffic, making the decision to circle the block to eat up some time. He made a left on Rue de Mont Blanc, and here he saw four more FBI men watching the street. They were across from the hotel, standing in two groups of two, and obviously aware there were exits through some shops at the street here that also had doors that led to the lobby of the hotel. Good, thought Dom. HRT wasn't just going to bum-rush the conference. They were prepared with surveillance in case Ross tried to squirt out another exit. He made another left onto Rue du Centre-Ère. This was the end of the block, and he looked for FBI back here, but he saw no one. He presumed this meant the stores here, a luxury eyeglass shop and a men's clothing shop, didn't have access to the hotel, which was on the other side of the block. The fat snowflakes made it hard to see more than 100 yards, but as he reached the corner and prepared to make a left, ahead of him he saw a large white panel van rolling toward him. His first thought was that the HRT was even bigger than he'd thought. If they had come in three vehicles, they could haul as many as 36 people. That didn't sound right. He wondered if Albright had authority to make arrests other than just Ross. Perhaps this white van was a paddy wagon with which the FBI would haul in all the major players of the ITP. No, Dom decided. It was going to be tough enough for Albright to get away with the American citizen and get him across the bridge to the U.S. consulate. The arrest itself was going to create a massive international incident. Hauling in Swiss citizens, Italian citizens, German citizens? No, Dom thought. No way in hell Albright would have the authority to pull off something like that. He discounted the large vehicle approaching as a coincidence and turned left on Place Clayberry, and immediately he picked out a group of FBI surveillance cars parked near an employee entrance to the hotel and the ramp that went down to a loading bay and the underground parking garage. Their engines were running, and there were multiple men in each vehicle. They had been easy to spot, but Dom cut the guys some slack. At this stage of the arrest, the security teams cordoning off the area weren't worried about maintaining a low profile. They had to be ready to block the exits and support the triggermen inside the hotel if necessary. Dom passed the vehicles by the ramp to the parking lot and headed back around toward the front of the hotel, hoping Albright and his men would hurry up and end this thing. Mohammed Mobasheri was in the lead of the group when they arrived at the end of the narrow courtyard. He pushed through a long cut in the green mesh that covered the buildings, then held open a door for the others. This room was a small and simple office and storage facility for the groundskeeper of the property. A tiny work desk was on one wall, and all around the 10-by-10-foot room were shelves with equipment, tools, coiled extension cords, and other odds and ends. Against the wall were snow shovels and a gas-powered snowblower on wheels. At the far end of the little space was another of Mobasheri's men. He had a sledgehammer in his hand, and from the looks of it he'd apparently just knocked an impressive hole through the plaster and cinder block wall. It was 3 feet high by 1.5 feet wide, and it would just accommodate the procession if they passed through it slowly and carefully. As the Iranian put the sledgehammer on the ground and redonned his black jacket, Mobasheri extended a hand toward the black hole.
Miss Bertolli, if you will.
Where are you taking? Move!
His shout exploded in the small maintenance room. Bertoli, Ross, and the Iranians all climbed through the ragged portal and into the narrow and dark warehouse space at the back of a men's clothing store. They took a moment to brush off dust and bits of plaster, then continued out onto the sales floor. The light from the windows at the front of the shop was muted. It was an overcast day with a snowstorm blowing through after all, but as soon as Ross neared the front door, he saw a white panel truck pull up outside. This was their ride out of here. That much was plain. But a ride to where? Ross had no idea. His first inclination was to make a run for it the second he got out on the street. He was fast enough, and even though he wasn't dressed for the cold, this was downtown Geneva. It wasn't like he was up in the mountains. All he had to do was find a cop, or an FBI agent, or any public space, or just maybe, he could run right into the entrance of the first embassy he came across. Surely to God the Iranians wouldn't shoot him in the back if he made a break for it. As they neared the entrance, Mobashiri stopped Ross by touching his arm softly.
Clothes. Quickly. I want you to change your clothes.
Ethan looked around. The store was full of Lacoste clothing. Some of it was ski wear, so he grabbed some thick nylon pants and put them on, then looked for a heavy sweater. While he did this, Gianna Bertoli had grown uncharacteristically silent. It was clear to Ross she realized that she had completely lost control of the situation, and she was scared. Her concern only gave Ethan more incentive to try to get away from these men. In seconds he had changed all his clothing, even slipping on a pair of rubber boots. Mobashiri gave him a satisfied nod, and then one of the Iranian Quds men unlocked the glass door of the clothing store. Ethan's heart pounded, and he gulped the warm air of the shop. This was his chance. By his second loop around the block, Dom was convinced something had gone wrong on the inside of the hotel. He knew the HRT guys would want to enter the conference quickly and use speed and surprise to overwhelm their target and his security. Every single minute they sat around inside that building was one more minute where some security guard or cop in attendance could throw a wrench into the works. And just then, as if on cue, Dominic heard sirens coming from the direction of the bridge over the Rhone. The local police were on the way, and Dom hoped like hell Albright could effect his takedown and get the fuck out of there before men with guns and questions showed up to find out what the hell the dozen or so American guys in coveralls were doing milling about the five-star hotel. Just as Dom made his left turn onto Rue de Saint-Rier, the far side of the block from the hotel entrance, he noticed the white van again. It had pulled to the curb next to a men's clothing shop. Dom looked back over his left shoulder for the FBI surveillance unit on the street on Rue de Mont Blanc. He could see their cars through the snow, but they were 50 yards away and facing the opposite direction. Dom slowed, then braked suddenly when he saw the door to the darkened clothing store open and Ethan Ross appear. He was just a step ahead of a group of several other men and one woman, but unlike the rest of the group, Ross was running like hell.
"No, no, no," Dom mumbled in astonishment.
Ethan took flight as soon as he was outside, sprinting to the right of the door, trying to make it around the front of the van. He clearly surprised Muhammad and his men, because he managed to get 10 feet of separation on the sidewalk in just a few bounds. The snow on the sidewalk had been ankle deep, and when he landed in the street he slipped a little on the compact, icy surface. He managed to right himself and keep going. He was nearly past the front grille of the white van when the driver put the vehicle in gear and stomped on the accelerator. The van lurched forward and delivered a glancing but powerful blow to the fleeing American, hitting him on his left side, spinning him through the air, and upending him. Ross crashed to the ground on his back, not 50 feet in front of Caruso.
Holy shit!
Dom shouted into his motorcycle helmet. His first inclination was to race over to Ross, either to scoop him up and make a run for it, or to run him down a second time. But three men surrounded his prostrate form in the snow-covered street. They rolled him onto his stomach, then yanked him back up to his feet roughly. Dom just sat on his rumbling BMW motorcycle as the group moved as a unit around Ross. They pushed and pulled him back onto the sidewalk and into the side of the van, and then the vehicle rolled off in Dom's direction. Caruso let it pass, then watched it from over his shoulder as it made a left on Rue de Mont Blanc. When it had completely disappeared from view, Caruso revved his engine, snapped his bike into gear, and spun on the snow. He burned a 180-degree turn in place and took off in pursuit of the American traitor. 45. Ethan lay on his back in the rear of the van. Next to him, Gianna Bertoli sat with her coat wrapped around her. True to his word, Mobasheri had packed up her luggage, and it, along with Ross's, sat by the back door of the vehicle. She'd pulled her coat off as soon as she'd climbed inside, and now she sat next to Ethan, but she didn't render him any aid, as she was consumed by her own thoughts and worries. Ethan's hip and his back and his arm hurt from the impacts from the truck and the hard-packed snow in the street. He didn't think anything had been broken, but he wasn't sure. Mohammed was sitting in the middle row of seats. He turned and looked back at Ethan. "Are you okay?" The concern in his voice seemed genuine. "You could have fucking killed me." Mohammed smiled, spun around forward, and said something in Farsi to the others. Instantly, two men leapt on top of Ethan and began pulling at his clothing. "What are you doing?" "You ran away, but you didn't have your computer. The scrape is not on the computer, is it? You have a drive on you."
"No!"
he screamed. It took them a minute. They stripped him down to nothing, rummaged through his clothes as he lay naked and fetal. One man pulled his arms away from him and another his legs. They were ready to begin a body cavity search, but Ethan shouted to stop them.
"Okay, okay!"
He reached to his hip and tore off the moleskin patch. It was passed up the van to Mohammed, who pried the microdrive off the adhesive. He nodded appreciatively. "Well done, Ethan. Well done. The computer was just a decoy." Ethan pulled his clothes back on. While he did so, he said to Mohammed, "You are Quds Force, aren't you?" "I am Revolutionary Guard, on a mission by order of the Supreme Leader. These men are Quds Force."
"Where are we going?"
Bertoli shouted the question. She'd been forgotten in the corner of the van. Mohammed seemed to weigh whether or not to respond for a moment. Finally, he said, "You see what happens if you try to escape, yes?" Both Bertoli and Ross nodded. "We are going to Genoa."
"Genoa, Italy?"
Bertoli was confused. "What's in Genoa?" Mohammed smiled. "A boat that will take us to Libya." Bertoli began shouting a string of obscenities, making it crystal clear she had no desire to go to Libya. Ross, on the other hand, tried a different tactic.
"It's got to be 4-5 hours to Genoa. We'll never make it before the Americans figure out where we are."
Mohammed waved away the comment. "Let me worry about that, Mr. Ross. You need to worry about what we are going to ask of you when we get where we are going." Ross knew what they wanted. They wanted the password. He told himself he would never give it to him. But thinking about the lengths they would go to force him to reveal his password made him close his eyes and shudder. Dom Caruso was a skilled motorcyclist, but he'd never before raced a road bike on icy streets while his helmet visor was half covered with wet snowfall. And on top of all this, he had to break his concentration to make a phone call. For the first few minutes of his tail on the van, they traveled through the narrow, winding streets of downtown Geneva, with intersections every 100 yards and large buildings that obstructed his view. He couldn't make it to the phone in his pack. He had to give all his attention to not losing